This is a podcast which is focused on an overview of the book Reading Lives, Working Class Children and Literacy Learning by Deborah Hicks. This podcast will introduce some terminology that Dr. Hicks uses in her book that may be new to some of you. And what I try to do is talk about the terminology, giving some examples that may make reading chapter two a little bit easier and smoother for you. The best way to approach this would be to have your book open to chapter two. It begins on page 15. What I'll do is I'll go through the chapter and refer you to certain page numbers and perhaps paragraphs where the terminology is, try to talk through what Dr. Hicks is getting at with her use of the terminology. And then after the podcast is over, when you read through the chapter, hopefully it will, these terms will be a little more familiar and palatable to you. So we'll begin with page 15, chapter 2, Situated Histories of Learning. And what Dr. Hicks is doing in this chapter is giving readers a theoretical foundation for her work. And she's really taking some of the traditional terminology with literacy and identity, power, and working class, things like that, and she's doing something different with the terminology. One thing to think about is in some of our readings thus far, we've already been introduced to different definitions of what literacy is, that literacy is not just reading and writing. And that's one of Dr. Hicks's arguments in this text, is that literacy is much more than cognitive processes. It's also cultural processes, and she's going to elaborate on that throughout the book. That's where her data comes from, is this idea of cultural literacy and what that's all about. So on page 15, she begins with saying in that second sentence there about a myth of literacy. And it says, this is the myth that children approach literacy practices as autonomous reasoners who then individually construct knowledge about literacy practices. So right there, she's letting us know that she's not buying into that myth, that she's saying that literacy is a social and cultural practice, that literacy learning does not take place in the mind of a human, but it takes place in social activity and cultural activity and things that happen outside of school. So it's not a school-based cognitive individualized activity, but it's something much more than that. And that's what her research is all about. On the next page, she goes into the section of myths of autonomy, and in that first paragraph, she's go down about six lines or so. The idea that literacies are cultural and material practices shaped by histories, localities, and the persons within them that give form and meaning to children's lives has been resisted in part because psychology's strong hold on educational theory and practice. And so she's making an argument there that, again, that literacies are cultural and material practices that matter. What matters is where you come from, your family, what kind of family literacy is a child involved in? What sort of place do they live in? Do they live in a rural, urban, suburban place? Do they have a family of parents who read and value reading? All of those things are really important, and not just the psychological basis of reading, but also the cultural and material and social practices of reading. She gives an example of this idea of cultural and material practices with literacy. In a few lines below that, you might see the word naming italicized. She writes, culturally and critically focused research has, however, challenged the notion that even something as simple as naming could exist outside of social, material, and affective relations with one another's. So in other words, children name things, and it's part of their literacy practice. But also they are named. They come to school knowing who they are as literacy learners. Many of you have written in your blogs about reading groups and SRA kits and you know what children bring to the table when they learn to read, or even as adolescent readers, and they come to know themselves as good readers or bad readers or struggling readers or all these categories and names that have already been put on them, labels, if you will. So that is something that she is claiming is a cultural practice, that this idea of naming is something that is embedded in our culture and that it is very much a part of how children and adolescents learn to view themselves as readers. On the next page, on page 17, she's also making an argument against the idea of reading as mastery. There's something more to literacy than just mastering a text, and that's also going to be evident in her research. She gives an example of all of this on page 19, where she's got an excerpt of data from her research. What she's making a case for here is that literacy is not just written. She's arguing here that this is a cultural process that tells us a lot about how, what she says on the next page, about how children engage with school literacies. If you look on page 20, the first indented paragraph, it says, "Cultural literacy researchers might tell their readers about processes of socialization that involve language practices, ways of acting, values, and beliefs." Now, that statement is really important because that is basically the definition of discourse that she is using in her book. So if you take a moment and write the word discourse right there outside of that sentence, maybe in the margin, a lot of times when people see the word discourse, they think words. But discourse, in the way that she's using it, is redefined in a lot of postmodern research, and discourse becomes not only language practices, but also ways of acting, values, and beliefs that become visible through language. Here's an example of what I mean. A lot of you in this course right now are Southern women. So think about this. There's a discourse of Southern womanhood that you probably are very well aware of. There's ways of being a Southern woman in North Carolina that are very particular. And if you grew up as a Southern girl, you probably internalized a lot of those codes and ways of being and practices and values and beliefs. And therefore, when you got older and maybe you started experimenting with different ways of being, it went against that discourse of Southern womanhood. And you probably felt that in your bones a lot of times. So that would be an example of a discourse. Now what happens is, as a Southern woman, if you have internalized that discourse, you behave a certain way, you act a certain way, and even if you don't, there's the expectation there within the discourse. You can accept a discourse, you can refuse it. And that's where the idea of language comes in, and language practices make visible discourses, or they refuse discourses in the way that you might speak, in the way that you might do school, in the way that you talk with others. All kinds of different cultural and material things happen with discourse. So that's what she's talking about here. If you look on that same paragraph there, just scroll down a little bit, says she's talking about the excerpt on the previous page. Jake and Leanne were being socialized into ways of being, knowing, talking, acting, and feeling. Again, this is discourse. This is, again, it's more than just language. It's being, knowing, talking, acting, and feeling. It's all of that. And we're socialized into a discourse. We're taught how to accept a discourse. And we don't even know that we're doing that. And that's the process that's called socialization. So this idea of socialization and discourse and literacy is something that Hicks is using in this book to talk about working class kids and how their class position is something that influences their literacy learning. In the next paragraph and on to page 21, she begins talking about relations of power, gender, and class. And she talks about these as shifting. What that simply means is that let me go back to the idea of Southern womanhood again. And those of you who aren't Southern women, just maybe you know enough about living in the South to understand this example. But let's say you as a Southern woman, you grew up as a Southern girl, you went off to college somewhere, and then you would come back home, and it would be more difficult for you to quote, be Southern, because you expanded your social world. You began to pick up habits and values and beliefs that necessarily weren't part of your discursive community. Well, that's what she means by shifting location or shifting identity. On page 21, she says in the first indented paragraph, none of the discursive locations and associated power relations are fixed or unchanging. They are shifting relations between discourses. They complicate or refract the identities. Children can gain or lose power and associated kinds of knowledge as they take up social discourses. They can talk, act, and know in hybrid ways as well. So that's really important to think about here, because what happens when you're a part of a discourse and you move away from that discourse and you move into another one is you have to shift yourself a little bit. When I go home, as you know, I grew up in suburban Atlanta, in a pretty small town outside of Atlanta. And when I go home, I'm not a professor anymore. I'm not an academic. None of my family is college educated. So I have to shift my identity. I have to shift my location. I'm moving from one discourse of academic life into another discourse of Southern life. And the two are really incompatible. And so I have to figure out a way to, you know, exist in both worlds and be hybrid. I can't completely lose myself in either world. In academia, there's still a part of this Southern girl in me, this idea of being a people pleaser and some other cultural expectations that, you know, that haunt me in my daily life in academia. So I have to deal with that and figure out how to be a hybrid subject, so to speak. And so that's what she's talking about here, is that these children that she's interviewing and following for her study live hybrid lives. They come from working class families where there are certain values and cultures, and then they move into a school culture that's largely middle class and white. And, you know, we've spent the course talking a lot about language and identity and how language works to force people to shift their identity. Well, her book is about the same thing, except she's just looking at socioeconomic class. So discourse is shifting, identities are shifting, power is shifting. You know, children may have some power at home because they, for whatever reason, they may be firstborn males at home, and then may have some power. But then they come to school, and if they're working class and they don't have strong print literacy skills, then, and they're labeled as struggling readers, then their power shifts, and they no longer are able to be in a position of power at school. So that's what this idea of hybrid identity, shifting locations, shifting discourses, that's what that's all about. Now, on page 22, she's giving two examples of cultural and critical readings on learning. She's going to discuss Shirley Bryce Heath's work called Ways with Words, which is a classic research that looks at language practices with an Appalachian community. And so she's going to give a summary of that, and she's going to give examples of how the cultural discourses worked within the community. So read that carefully. And then she talks about Valerie Walker Dean's work and discourse, and she gives some a summary of that. And so pay close attention to what discourse looks like in these examples, what gender locations look like, what power looks like, and how literacy plays out in both of these examples. And both of those, the examples here, will give you more to think about in terms of that terminology. And it will also is a precursor to her own study, because she uses Heath's work and Walker Dean's work to inform what she does. So I hope that this quick podcast helps you think about the terminology in the book. If you have further questions about it, please post it on the blog, and I can answer that on the blog, or I can create another podcast. Happy reading, everyone.